And I'll talk and we'll make sure it's loud enough.
Right, okay. This is the an interview with Judy Hudson by Bonnie Spanier.
Okay.
Okay, and the date is June 9th, 1997, and we're in Judy Hudson's house. And so I've asked Judy to talk about in what capacities she's been involved with women's studies at the University at Albany, when she first became involved, and what were the circumstances of that, and then we can get into some other stuff.
Well, I first became involved, let me go back to before I came to SUNY Albany, because, you know, how did I get interested in women's studies? Well, I really didn't know much about women's studies, and in 1977-78, I went back to school for a second master's at the College of Human Development at Penn State. And this was in a program, an interdisciplinary program called Individual and Family Studies, which was looking at sociological and psychological aspects of the development of individuals and of families. And I got really interested in sex role. And I used to say that I got my master's in sex role because I tailored everything towards that. And then when I came here, the summer that I came here before I started working at the university, there was a conference at Cornell on androgyny, which was an interest of mine, and I decided to go to it. So I called the conference people and I said, was there anyone from the Albany area who was going to the conference, because I thought perhaps we could share a ride and it would give me a chance to meet somebody in the neighborhood, sort of, because I didn't know anybody or very few people here. And it turned out that Liv Burns, who was in the counseling center at the university, was going to the conference. And she called me, or I called her, and we shared a ride there, and in fact, I think we, as I recall, we shared a room there. And it was a wonderful conference. Some of my friends from graduate school were there, unbeknownst to me. They attended too. Anyway, so then when I got the job at the university, I called Lib and I said, guess what, I got the job at the university. And she said, oh, good. And this was in the fall of 79. We got together a few times for lunch over the period of the year. And at the end of the school year, she said that she had been on the Women's Studies Advisory Committee. And they were looking for new people, and would I be interested in participating, that she thought I might be interested. And I said, yes, I would. For a number of reasons. One was that I was interested in the area of women's studies, although I still didn't know a great deal about it. But I knew enough to know that it was something I was concerned about. Another reason I had was because the job that I had and have had in the library was one that really didn't give me much contact with faculty, or students for that matter. And I wanted that contact because you don't want to work in a vacuum. At least I don't. So I said, yes, I would be interested. And she said, oh, good. She said, there are some very strong people in the women's studies program, and I think it would be good to have an example of a straight woman there. And I thought, whoa. But I went there, and that's how I got started. She gave my name to Chris Bowes, and who was director at the time, and Chris called in April or May or whatever and said that they were having an advance out at her place in Delanson, and would I like to come? It would give me a chance to meet people. And I said, sure, I'd love to. And so I went out there. I remember the directions well, because you went out Route 20 until you came to a giant chicken, and then you turned left. Anyway, I don't remember the rest of the directions, but that stuck in my mind. At any rate, and we were there, and here were all these women, of course, none of whom I had met before. And I have said before what happened that morning. We had all gone outside, and we sat down on the ground, and we were talking. And I remember hearing someone say, "Where are Judy and Joan?" And someone else said, "Oh, they'll be along." And pretty soon, a car drove up and the door slammed, and somebody said, "Oh, here are Judy and Joan." And these two blonde Valkyries came walking up. I mean, the sun was just shining on their hair, you know, these blonde, statuesque, attractive women. It was very impressive. And I remember meeting Ellen Higgins at that event. Ellen lived in the community. She was not really affiliated with the university at that time at all, but was interested in women's studies, as she still is. And we gravitated together because we were both new kids. The next fall, we had, at the first meeting, I think, that was at someone's house, I remember that someone talked a bit about, first about all the jargon that we tend to use. And people tried to define some of the jargon. What was an IFR, for example? And, you know, what was an FTE, and so forth and so on. And then there was some more talk, and someone said that they had the feeling that there was an in-group in the women's studies program. And we talked a little bit about how, not so much whether that was true, but how to integrate new people into the group so that they might not feel that way. And someone, I'm not sure who it was, suggested that instead of having Chris convene all the meetings and lead the meeting, that two of the new people be asked to be co-coordinators, essentially, of the Women's Studies Advisory Committee. And so Ellen and I volunteered to do that. And it was a wonderful way to get introduced to women's studies, because we would meet with Chris before each meeting, and she would sort of brief us on her issues. And then we would set up an agenda based on that. And it worked very well, I think. I think it made it easier for Chris, because she didn't have to conduct a meeting at the same time that she was trying to make the points that she needed to make and get the information that she needed to get. And for us, for me, it was a wonderful introduction to the program, and I learned a great deal from it. And I think it brought me into the program in a way that that certainly I wouldn't have become involved anywhere near as deeply had I had another kind of introduction to the program. We did that for the first year, and then the next year, it didn't work. The idea was that some new people then would do this, and whether there were people who just, they were not willing to do it or what, I don't recall, but it didn't work out for the next year, and so that's something that dropped. And I think it's too bad, it was too bad. I don't think that's a relevant kind of thing now, but at the time it was, and it could have continued. But because I was fairly conversant with what was going on, of course, I was able to participate in women's studies in a variety of ways. For example, early on, and I'm not sure whether it was the first or the second or the third year, but I have a feeling it was the first or second year. We did, there was a feeling that we should have some bylaws. And so there was a committee of three of us. I believe it was, well, it was Mary Jo Long, who was a lawyer in the community, who has subsequently left the community. And she was really not very active in the program, except for participating in this drawing up of the bylaws. And Margaret Clemens, who was a student, a senior at that time, who went on to go to law school, and I worked on the bylaws. And these were the first bylaws that the program had had.
Was Margaret Clemens a women's studies student?
She was a women's studies major.
Uh-huh.
Right. And I think she won an award. I think it might have been the Ada Craig Walker Award, but I'm not sure, because we didn't have any women's studies award at that time. She was a returning student. She had a couple of children, and she was a very, very good kind of person, you know. When she said she'd do something, she would do it, and so forth. You know, I thought a lot of her. Soon after that, at some meeting, we were talking about programming. And I had mentioned that at Penn State, when I was at Penn State, they had a program where they brought, let me back up and say that I worked in a library that served the gerontology program there. And for the gerontology students, they had a program where the students took a course, a one-credit course, and the school brought in people, researchers in gerontology, and they would give a talk every two or three weeks. There would be someone coming in, and the students were expected to attend the presentations, and then I don't even know what they did, whether they had a seminar to discuss that afterwards, I'm not sure. But we began talking about programming that we could do, and I mentioned that, and the upshot of it was that we decided to have the Brown Bag Lunches, the Research on Women Colloquia, and Judy Federley and I agreed to talk about it and set it up. And so we did. She and I got together. I remember we walked over to Stuyvesant Plaza and had lunch and walked back. And we sort of did some blue skying about who we might invite to give these colloquia. The idea was to ask people at the university and in the Capital District area who were doing research on women to talk about their research. It didn't necessarily have to be completed research. People sometimes, often, talked about research that was in progress. And so, and the first person was actually Ruth Schmidt, who was visiting, and Judy, of course, knew her. I never knew her. And there were, I don't know, 40 or 50 people at that meeting, and I thought, wow, this is a great success. Well, of course, that was the best attended one we ever had, and it was because it was Ruth Schmidt, and people who had known her came, and she gave a very nice presentation, of course. And that program went on for 4 or 5 years, and I did it. Judy got busy doing other things, and I got to the point where everywhere I would go, I would just keep my eyes open, my ears open, to find out who was doing what, you know, and then I would approach them. And my theory was, and my practice was, to ask them to do something the following year, mm-hmm. figuring that people will agree to do anything a year from now. And they did. And it worked out pretty well, although towards the end, attendance fell off, and eventually, I think after you came in, we decided to let it go. People had gotten busy, and it may be that there wasn't as much curiosity about women's studies as there had been in the past, because back in, even in the early 80s, it was still a fairly new area, and people didn't really know what it was.
But for me, that was very interesting too, because I got to hear all of them, of course, and I got to know a lot of people and learn a little bit more about how you get things done at the university, how you get things publicized and so forth. And it developed into a routine after a while. I'm trying to think about what else I've done. I was active on fundraising committees. I've been active on those over the years. And and we've had a number. We've had, I remember the first time Bernie Sandler was here, we had a dessert party at Jones and Francine. And that was a lovely occasion. I don't know that we made a tremendous amount of money, but that was a very nice occasion.
I think we actually did. Joan has pointed to that as being one of the more successful ones.
I remember when Toni Morrison was here, and we did. We arranged for a benefit performance of her play Dreaming Emma, and that was very successful. It was fully subscribed. I know because I was in charge of the tickets. And I think we did make quite a bit of money off of that, too. And then there was the Sarah Cohen play. I'll never forget, you gave me a copy of the play, Bonnie, and I read it, and it was so raunchy. And I thought, oh, this is so raunchy. But of course, when I saw the play, it was wonderfully funny. And I think we made a lot of money out of that,
yes,
too.
Yes, we did. Yeah, yeah.
Through her generosity.
Right.
Right.
Well, just to put that in context, she needed a university sponsor in order to do that. And
right. So
that, you know, that was what she started out looking for and then very generously made it a fundraiser for us. So
right.
That was great.
Which, I mean, she's done that for the disability.
The students.
The biggest student program, too. And it's very commendable. And her plays are lots of fun. I mean, I always go to them, too. And I don't know, and then it kind of, the fundraising got put aside, and I hope that that's something that we can get back to at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that it would be a good idea to try and locate as many of our alums as we can and fundraise that way. And not just for fundraising, but I think it would be wonderful occasionally to have a few of them come back and talk to the students, you know, and say, here's what my women's studies background has meant to me in my life. Because I suspect that many students don't really have a clue about what it's going to mean for them in the future. Although there have been many students who have been very well focused. But those are the ones we tend to remember because they've been so focused and you know, had it all together.
I just want to get years straight here, timing and stuff. What year did you come to the university?
I came to the university in the fall of 1979, and I joined the Women's Studies program in the fall of 1980. And
it really was through Lib Burns,
she was the person who recommended me. Now, she was no longer a part of Women's Studies after that. She, you know, she had left the advisory committee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was someone else I wanted to mention, too, in terms of people that I haven't heard anybody say anything about, and that is when I came up for tenure, of course, Women's Studies was supported me. And there was someone who was on the CPCA at that time who she was probably on the advisory committee. I don't know how active she was. Her name was Sarah Shifter. And Sarah subsequently, I believe, remarried and was then Sarah Cohen, and then she left.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember that I sort of knew who she was. And after I you know, got the results of the CPCA committee, I was at some function and she was coming and I wanted to go over and thank her. And she came and she said, "Who's Judy Hudson? I want to see who she is." But I never knew her, so mm-hmm. I think she was in Hispanic and Italian studies. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that she taught courses for
way back. I think she created the course on Hispanic women's literature or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And then Edna has taught it more recently. And Hispanic, of course, is not necessarily the term that they would use now,
right.
but.
Yeah.
I think she started that mm-hmm. way back, and mm-hmm. that was, you know, her contribution.
Well, I think that Francine did mention her, mm-hmm. but no one else has mentioned her because she's gone, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So once we became a department, it depended on what was happening in my professional life too. You know, as I got busier. I got involved with a variety of things in the library field. I have somewhat less time for women's studies. And then in about the early 90s, at one point, I felt that I really had gotten too far away from women's studies. So I ran for the steering committee and served on the steering committee for 2 years, and that was very good. And actually, during that time and before that time, I had served on the scholarship and awards committee too. That was the Judy committee for a while because Judy Barlow was chair and Judy Federley and I were on it for I think 2 years, and then I was off of it for a couple of years, and then this past year Linda Pershing asked me if I would serve on it, and Judy Barlow and I served on it, and that's probably the best committee ever to serve on because it's a happy committee.
Yeah.
You get to do something nice for people, although sometimes it's hard to make the decision.
Mm-hmm. I wondered about, you know, you working full-time in the library and doing research and publications related to that work that also crisscross a lot with mm-hmm. the women's studies arena, but why do you think what were some of the motivations or maybe the benefits or whatever for your being, you know, really doing a kind mm-hmm. of double duty? You know, you didn't have to mm-hmm. do this involvement with women's studies to the degree that you did over the years. And I wondered if you could say something.
Well, of course, I believed in it. That was part of it.
Do you want to say more about what you believe? I mean, you know, believed in it, make that more explicit about what that meant
I
to you.
Well, I think that... women's studies provides a perspective on life in this society I'm not very good at putting this into words, that sees the contributions that women make, B, women can make. It also exposes the discrimination that we've all experienced in our lives. I suppose the reason I'm so interested in it is because I'm a woman, and I've experienced some of these things, not to a terrible degree, but I see that they're out there, and it's unfair and unjust, and I want to work for a just society. I suppose one could ask, well, why didn't you make this kind of contribution to Africana studies, after all? The same thing's true there, except we're talking about racism instead of sexism, and I guess the answer to that is because I'm a woman, and it hits harder and closer. Aside from the whole question about whether I would be welcome there, which is a whole other thing. So that's one reason for making the efforts that I've made for women's studies. I think another is the reason that I said before, and that is that it gave me an entree to a part of the university that I wouldn't have had otherwise. I really never had the desire to teach, but at the college where I used to work, because I worked at the reference desk and because I did teaching bibliographic instruction, I had contact with faculty and I had contact with students, and I didn't have that here. And I really missed it. It's very hard to work in that kind of a vacuum. After all, it's the faculty and the students who are the people for whom the library is set up. And I personally find it difficult not to have contact with them. So it enriched the experience that I had, and it made me a better librarian. And of course, it led to a lot of things which most people wouldn't say were necessarily pleasant things. Service on CPCA, for example. But again, it gave me an opportunity to make a contribution to the institution in a way that I might not have been had I just been, you know, stayed in my little job. I look at some of the other librarians who have not made this, who have not had this kind of opportunity because I was fortunate in that I was interested in an area that was so open and welcoming to everyone who came to it. And I see that I have had a much richer experience than they have, or at least I believe I have had. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. That's why I've done it. And it's been great. It has also shaped the kind of research that I did in library work. Research is such a heavy word, you know, the work that I've done in the library field, because I was able to use my interest in women's studies and to find ways to make a contribution to women's studies through the kind of research that I did. The indexing projects that I did that looked at the indexing of periodicals, feminist periodicals, was really my attempt to do activist research in women's studies by not just finding out what was indexed and so forth, but then going back to the publishers, the indexing publishers, and saying, you really should be including these other things. And we got some good response from them. So, you know, it's all mixed up together. It's a whole, I guess we're all a whole combination of all these things.
Yeah. I wondered about in your reflecting on your period of time involved with women's studies, how, you know, some kind of perspective on how you think in that period of time that women's studies was trying to deal with the issue of diversity, and you mentioned racism and, mm-hmm. You know, other isms and mm-hmm. stuff, and mm-hmm. I don't know if you have a perspective on that effort, because obviously the program was founded by white women who were pretty much the only women at the university, mm-hmm. almost, mm-hmm. And faculty has become a little more diverse over time through various efforts and such, and also by the university making a better effort to increase diversity of faculty hiring and such, but, and you know, and that's a central issue in women's studies, trying to address, you know, heterosexism and, you know, the range of lesbian mm-hmm. gay experiences and racism and the range of diverse heritages and such. I don't know if that's, you know, something you want to shed some light on.
Well, I don't know that I have anything new to shed on it. I think that bringing diversity into women's studies has been a problem. I think that the first couple of years that I was involved with women's studies, I wasn't aware of that, but mostly because I really wasn't aware of what the curriculum involved and so forth, and it wasn't an issue that was discussed very much. But I would say from, I think Iris, when Iris came in, I think she began to raise the issue. And I think we've been grappling with it ever since. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know whether we'll ever be able to successfully deal with that. I hope we will. But because I think we're much better off now because we have a few women of color involved in women's studies, and until we had that, it was very difficult to try and even address the issues because we haven't walked in the steps and lived the life and so forth. And to a certain extent, I believe you can teach someone who is not a part of a group can teach about the group in a true sort of a way. But at a certain point, you have to have the people who are within the group mm-hmm. teaching about themselves. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. really what I think about it.
Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking about the future, and you know where we will go, and whether we will be able to. Let me back up and talk a little bit about 2 years ago, I guess, and last year when the university has been looking at its. The way it's been organized and trying to downsize and so forth, and these plans of trying to combine women's studies and Africana studies and into some kind of gender and ethnic ghetto. and in a sense, I can see some value. I could see. In the best of all possible worlds, I could see that, there being a value in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are many commonalities. But unfortunately, this is not the best of all possible worlds. And furthermore, I think this is the danger of ghettoizing, of putting everything that is interdisciplinary or ethnic or whatever, however you want to characterize that particular group of things in one lump, in one place, is a very dangerous thing because it exposes them. It's much easier to cut off their head than if there's only one head.
Mm-hmm.
And at a time like this, when we seem to be under attack, we have to be aware of these kinds of dangers, and we certainly are.
Mm-hmm. Is it appropriate in this interview, I don't know how much you want to do this, because I could have, I'll just say it. And then if it's, yeah, right. I mean,
yeah.
Well, it's less of an asking and more of an exploring,
mm-hmm.
Because someone who, Michelle Ford, who's been working with the Teaching Collective internship this year, gave a short statement, or her statement was read at the celebration this year, and it was some... embedded in it was some kind of comment about how she'd been looking at the early
mm-hmm.
organizings, or the origins, rather, of the collective, Teaching Collective and Intro, and that she made some kind of statement about, you know, that after a while, you know, race and class were sort of added to the content of Intro, or something of that kind, and Joan Schultz, who was involved in the first thing, you know, really talked about that with me afterwards and took exception to that, and I think I would like to have a conversation with Michelle about what she was looking
right.
at,
because
the intro stuff to begin with, and over many years,
mm-hmm.
Has had had identified as very important topics, the quote, other oppressions. Now, it took a while, I think, in the development of feminist thinking in academe to talk about these things as really simultaneous, interlocking, et cetera, et cetera, and it's a much more accurate and better analysis and all that, I think Joan sort of wanted credit, enough credit for those early days when the kinds of grappling with the issue of how sexism and racism and such, as unsuccessful as they might have been compared to what we're able to do now and what we do and try to do. So that there's sort of a difference between not doing anything and really being so blind about things, or so, I'm sorry, blind is not a good word, but really seeing that gender, the difference between saying gender is the primary oppression, which a few Marxist feminists or some people, I guess, said first or whatever, versus understanding that it's much more complicated and you don't order them and all that sort of stuff. So,
I actually, because I didn't come from teaching, I really have had very little, had almost, with the exception of taking your research seminar, I've had no experience with the coursework in women's studies, and I never felt, I think if I were still going to be around in the next few years, I would want to get involved in the curriculum because I want to know more about it. But I was very reluctant at one time to sort of, because I didn't know anything about it, I thought, well, you know, who am I to make decisions and recommendations and so forth on the curriculum. I think that was a mistake because that would have been the way to learn about it. As a result, my exposure to it is mostly as a participant in the advisory committee meetings, in the department meetings, as a listener, as a watcher. So I really can't speak to that. I mean, I know what I've learned from doing these interviews. I know that early on there was an effort to get some of these issues into the courses, and to get classism, racism, sexism was one of the early courses too. But I can't judge because I was only on the sidelines in this particular area.
I have another question about your reflections on the days when the program, in the earlier days, when the advisory committee was much more fluid, when, as you said, I think that it was really an atmosphere in which everyone was welcomed, or, you know, was outreach and open arms, and that, at least a feeling of that. And we've become certainly more of an academic unit, trying, though, supposedly to preserve some of those special things about women's studies. And so I don't know, I wondered if that was one thing, whether, you know, you had any reflections about sort of the feeling of, you know, the involvement with women's studies as it has really become so much more of a successful academic department.
Well, I think that it was a more exciting time because there was a much larger, more diverse group. I mean, diverse in the sense that it wasn't just university people. But I don't necessarily, I'm not sure that we don't have a better program now than we did then, because the program has matured. I guess I am concerned, someone else raised this concern, and I agree that I am concerned that we're not bringing new people in. And I think that's something that, I hope that's something that will be attended to look at the incoming faculty and invite them to become involved. I forget who it was. I think maybe it was Iris who raised this the question of the structure that we have now is such that people don't become voting members until joint faculty don't become voting members until they get tenure, and we might want to look at that.
Yeah.
Because in fact, why would anybody get involved then?
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, if they're going to be
mm-hmm.
just junior members, I mean, yeah. really junior members.
Right. So interesting. Well, anyway, that's a, yeah.
Yeah. So it's something that I hope that
right.
Women's Studies will take a look at, because here people are retiring and leaving the university, and there's nobody else coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And during the first years, there was turnover, but there were always people coming in. And we don't have those people coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no guarantee that as people, for example, that Francine's line will be filled.
Right.
We have I mean, as far as I know, it's not being. And so I think we've gotten a little comfortable, a little too comfortable in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
We've had other battles to fight. I mean, it's not that we have just been sitting on our laurels and saying, aren't we wonderful? Although we do that a lot, and rightly so. But we don't sit on our laurels. But I do think this is one area that
mm-hmm.
is important to attend to.
Mm. Are there any other kinds of you know, changes or re-emphasis of certain things that have been successful in the past or gotten more attention in the past?
I would like, this is not something that we've done in the past, but as I said, I would like us to begin to identify our alumni
mm-hmm.
and to utilize them in a variety of ways. I think that I know that women's studies changed a lot of women's lives. Being, you know, coming here and taking the courses changed their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they probably appreciate that. And many of them want to share that experience with others. And whether they can do it by making a monetary contribution or some other contribution to the department, I think many of them would be willing and eager to do it. But they haven't been asked because we haven't made an effort to identify them. And I don't know how you, I mean, I must say I think that the development people at the university, some of them are very good. And it might be worth consulting with them and
mm-hmm.
saying, how do we go about doing this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they may have some constructive ideas.
Yeah.
And certainly there are people like Candace Grodin who are, you know, not active in women's studies, but because of her interest in the women's community on campus, I'm sure she would be happy to
mm-hmm.
Make an effort
yeah.
to help.
You know, at the women's studies reception this last spring, because I was running it, I started to think about, are there any people whose phone numbers I have that I should just call up and say, why don't you come? And among them was the student, Elaine Reinecke, who is in the area, and I happen
mm-hmm.
to, she's been living in the same place, so I have her phone number. And I had been in, we had done the teaching collective together,
wow.
You know, about 12 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she came, and she graduated from, you know, she graduated and gotten a master's in social welfare and was being a social worker and was married, and I think she had a kid, I can't remember if she
mm-hmm.
had a child. And she was so thrilled, actually, to come to the reception, and we, you know, highlighted
mm-hmm.
her as one of
yeah.
the number of people and stuff, and I could see how important it could be in many, many ways, and
mm-hmm.
I think it just takes a couple of us sitting down and
right.
and just doing this in a couple of hours,
mm-hmm.
Tracking things down. So that's that kind of work.
Right.
That
and thinking about how to
and then what to
them.
Do.
Yeah.
Right.
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 Yeah. If I was going to be around, you know, I would want to be involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, that's a legacy I can't leave.
Is there anything else that...
I don't think so. I'm hoping that in my new life, I'll be able to make the kind of connection that I've made with women's studies here. Because it's been an important part of my life. And there have been wonderful years.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Okay.
Okay,
right.
We turn it back on again because I realized that I never mentioned working with Kathy Turek. Kathy is another one of the people like me who have full-time jobs outside the Women's Studies Department, but have made contributions, are interested and concerned with Women's Studies and have made contributions to it. And certainly I think her contributions have been wonderful. Her computer expertise is such a wonderful resource that we have been able to draw upon in a variety of ways, both in terms of her teaching that female-friendly computing and just her personal assistance for people who wanted to go online and learn how to use the electronic world instead of having it abuse them. And I think that having her in the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning can and will be an advantage because I know she's working with many of the Women's Studies faculty, with Vivian certainly, and some of the other faculty, in trying to utilize the electronics, whatever that we have available to us in teaching. But she certainly is very, very interested in many of the issues of women's studies. And she's very busy, but again, as she matures, she's going to be, continue, I think, to be a wonderful resource. So,
yeah. I just thought of someone else who's actually still here, but who hasn't been so active in recent years in women's studies, and that's Martha Rosette.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an example of a faculty member who never herself taught either a women's studies course or necessarily integrated a whole lot about women into her courses. And she certainly encouraged students to do that if that was their interest in papers and such, but... But Martha, I remember her saying to me at one point that she had become involved with women's studies, that stayed involved with women's studies over a number of years as an affiliated faculty member who's very active in a couple ways I'll mention, because of the community of women, of the group of women. She just really enjoyed working, in this situation, working with what she characterizes as this really wonderful group of women. And she said she got a lot out of it just from that perspective. Now, in terms of her contributions, Martha is one of the people who really knows how the institution works. And so over the years when I was director, and probably before that as well, she was really important in helping us figure out, how to do certain things in the institution,
right.
how to navigate our way through various sorts of things, both in terms of resources and a number of things like that. And I think she was also involved. She would often be involved in personnel situations,
mm-hmm.
where what you did was very important, and it was time-consuming and things like that. And she was also one of the people who was instrumental in proposing that Toni Morrison be given the Schweitzer Chair, which is the SUNY-wide chair, and come to Albany and come and be part of the Writers Institute, which was successful for a couple of years, and Toni Morrison to have her actually be affiliated with Women's Studies as well,
You mentioned the fundraising thing around her play, and that was quite extraordinary. And she also taught some courses, writing courses and content courses of literature and such, cross-listed with women's studies, which was great. So a number of us had the opportunity to actually get to know her a little bit, which was quite a remarkable thing. So I, mentioned Martha as somebody who's whose name wouldn't show up in the list of courses because she didn't do that, and whose commitment was really very important over the years.
Another person like that is Meredith Butler, who has made a number of wonderful contributions to women's studies, but they're not the kind of thing that shows. Although I think she did teach a course once. I don't know whether...
Gloria has been an instructor of record in the Intro to Feminism in that section. Now, Meredith may have done that.
I think she may have done it one semester early on. But of course, when she went into administration, again, she's another person who is there to help us strategize, because she knows how the system works too, perhaps at a different level. But we need to have that information from time to time.
Yeah, just to make that explicit, Meredith Butler was in the library. I mean, she had an appointment in the library, and then she was an assistant to...
She was an assistant vice president.
An assistant, to the vice president. Was she an assistant vice president?
I think she was.
Okay. To Warren Ilchman at one point, which was in academic affairs.
Right. And then she came back as director of the library, and she is the dean now, so she sits on the dean's council.
Mm-hmm. The dean of the...
Dean of the library.
Dean of the library, yeah. And another thing that Meredith did, which was really critical at a certain point, was she noticed that made us all aware in women's studies that... that women's studies faculty were not being represented among people who were getting awards and such, and honors at the university. And so, and again, that takes a certain amount of work, but it also takes a certain amount of really knowing how the institution works. And she really headed up the group that was willing to start nominating people appropriately for various awards and doing the work that's needed to, to get all that information together and write the letters and everything. And once that started, the reality was that, we have outstanding people, and they got the recognition. It wasn't, so it wasn't necessarily all that easy. And you see behind the scenes, there are times where, a particular dean or whatever was not particularly supportive of women, and therefore those people's names didn't go as far as they should have. But a lot of the lack of representation among the award winners was because we, just hadn't been doing the kind of work you need to do, and possibly assuming that, we wouldn't do well with it, and, in other words, it wouldn't get the awards. I mean, there's that whole thing about internalized discrimination and
that's
such.
Right.
And I think what we saw was that, one person alone doesn't overcome that, but a group of people. And then as more of the women involved with women's studies in various ways, not only got tenure, but then got promoted to full professor, or, whose work really became more visible. And then those people continued to be willing to put names forward and do the kind of constant commitment, really, that you need to have to maintain the growth of a feminist community in the various parts of it, not exclusively, women's studies.
Well, that's one of the unique or
unique
things about the Albany women's community, SUNY Albany women's community. It hasn't just happened. It's been people like Meredith and Gloria and other people who have recognized that you have to build a community. It doesn't just happen, and you have to tend it and keep it going. But it is a most unusual group of people And I don't know. I don't know. It's just, it really is amazing that we've been able to gain the recognition that we deserve.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's like, wow, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as though these things are puffery pieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of the people who have been recognized have had accomplishments that deserve recognition. But until somebody points that out, they're not going to get recognized publicly.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm.